From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. After another devastating school shooting, students and teachers erupt in protest across the country. They even met with President Trump. What do they want? The investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election rolls on. The Winter Olympics in South Korea are winding down. And the death of an American religious figure, Billy Graham, at the age of 99, we'll discuss his legacy. Let's start with an all-too-familiar story of a uniquely American tragedy, the massacre of 17 people at a school in the state of Florida. Students and parents nationwide are protesting, demanding action, and President Trump and other Republicans have gotten an earful in recent days. Tom, let's start with you. What is the message that the president and lawmakers have been hearing?
Well, what they've been hearing, especially from these kids, is you've got to start talking about guns and you've got to start doing something about guns. Yes, it's okay and it's important to do what the president wants to do, which is to have a greater emphasis on mental health, because in many of these massacres, the shooter has mental problems. But the overwhelming view of the kids is that guns are the biggest problem of all. There's almost, not quite, but there's almost as many guns in the United States as there are people. And
I think there are a lot more, actually, the data I've...
Well, whatever. It's a breathtaking...
It's a lot.
It's a breathtaking number. And something like 90% of the guns are owned by about 3% of the American public. But I think what the kids are really saying, get rid of these assault weapons or have greater control on assault weapons. You can vote. You can't vote until you're 18, but you can get an assault weapon if you're under the age of 18. And so I think what the kids are saying, it's not enough to say, well, we got to focus on this, we got to focus on that. We also have to focus on guns. And that politically, that's always been the most difficult thing for politicians to deal with because of the power of the National Rifle Association.
Now, the National Rifle Association, for sort of global listeners who might not know, this is a very powerful lobbying organization here in Washington that represents basically a gun sellers more than gun owners. It's mm-hmm. important to point that out. That being said, they have an awful lot of power, Linda. Mm-hmm. They contributed millions of dollars to mm-hmm. President Trump's campaign. They have an awful lot of power. Can anything really be done to satisfy what these students and teachers and parents are asking for?
I would say in the short term, no. We are in a very, very polarized political environment in Washington. The midterms are coming up. We started when the shooting happened last week. We had this extraordinary moment of outpouring of grief and instant activism by these teenagers. We haven't seen this before. This, I think, a lot of people were hopeful that this could turn into a positive movement. And there's going to be a march on March 24th. So in a month, we will see that impact. But this week, the whole situation just melted into name-calling and people sort of reverting to their corners. And so I think we're seeing a lot of suggestions, proposals. Even Donald Trump says he's willing to try certain things. He's not himself a gun person. He is a New York City guy. In the cities, guns are seen as weapons of death and destruction, not as something to use for hunting or for target practice. But Donald Trump is all about satisfying his base, which includes very much gun owners. And I have to say, it isn't just the power of the NRA. It's the power of the idea behind what they stand for, which is the right to bear arms, which is enshrined in our Constitution. Having said that, I think the activation of these young people, these teenagers and young adults who are sick and tired of seeing these mass shootings, whether it be in a school or at a concert or just anywhere. I mean, it could happen really anywhere. I think we are seeing perhaps the birth of a generation of young people who are going to grow up to become politically active and are not going to stop until they do see changes in our gun laws.
You know, on that point, when people talk about the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms, at the time that was written and codified and so forth, we had muskets, which are sort of a gun that could fire one bullet, and then you have to kind of, you know, re-put new gunpowder and so forth in it. Guns have certainly changed since then, and one complaint that these students and parents have and so forth is that the laws have not kept up with the massive firepower that these guns now have. Is that a legitimate point, Tom? And if it is, how do you overcome the opposition that that Linda was referring to?
Well, I think it is a legitimate point, but it's very difficult to overcome that opposition. But I think it's very a legitimate point. The weapon used in the Parkland, Florida shooting was an AR-15, which is a commercial version of the old Army M-16, which I have fired as an Army officer in my youth. And I can just tell you that the lethality of the M-16 AR-15 is not to be believed. Nobody needs an assault weapon to go hunt deer. It is a weapon of war, and the Supreme Court has ruled more than once that reasonable controls can be put on certain kinds of weapons. Even the late and many consider great Justice Antonin Scalia said you can restrict certain kinds of weapons. Now, President Trump said he's going to support a change in regulations that you cannot own one of these assault weapons like the AR-15 unless you're 21 years old. And he says, I've talked to the NRA and they're going to do the right thing. But I don't think he's correct about that. We will have to see. The reason this is so difficult is not just that there's a Second Amendment enshrining the right to bear arms, but I think it's an emotional issue as well beyond that. I think the National Rifle Association has done a very skillful job of convincing a lot of their constituents that if you do anything, in any way, no matter how modest, to control guns or the ability to get them, you're going down the slippery slope that eventually the United States government is going to take away your guns. They're going to confiscate guns. And I think that is intellectually dishonest and just not true. It won't happen. But the NRA has made that point, and they've sold it very skillfully to their base.
We've got to move on, but quickly on that one thing, I want to get a quick answer from both of you. You know, President Trump, as a private citizen, back in 2000, wrote in a book called The America We Deserve, I believe is the title, where he said, I support the ban on assault weapons. And yet when he was running for president, of course, if you want to win the Republican nomination, you can't say things like that. So he flipped. Deep down, which is the real Donald Trump?
I think that's the real Donald Trump. I think the Donald Trump of 2000 is a guy who sees people being mowed down with assault weapons and says, that's ridiculous. I think that's what Donald Trump really is about. But he's now wearing this Republican label and of today's Republican Party, which is very much about not allowing any new restrictions on guns.
Quickly, which is the real Donald Trump?
Linda's Donald Trump is the real Donald Trump.
Okay. Quite interesting. More to come on that topic, I am sure. Moving on, the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election continues. The Trump administration does acknowledge that the Russians did, in fact, meddle in the election, but it continues to insist that there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. That's a significant difference. Meantime, in the last week, a very significant development. 13 Russian individuals and a handful of Russian organizations, three, I believe, have been formally accused by the United States, by the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, of crimes concerning all of this stuff. Bring our listeners around the world up to speed on this investigation, Tom.
Well, part of me says that what Mr. Mueller did is a tactical move Clearly, he and his prosecutors think that the evidence is there to charge these Russians in absentia. But it's also a way to say, in effect, anyone who says this is all a hoax, look at these indictments. Again, the real argument is, was anyone in the Trump campaign in actively colluding with the Russians to help Hillary Clinton lose? And that debate will be continued for quite a long time. The president was told this would be over by Thanksgiving. Then he was told Christmas. Then he was told by January. And I think we're looking at weeks and months of a continuing investigation by Mr. Mueller, the special prosecutor.
Did they say Thanksgiving 2017 or a different
maybe 2020,
year?
Who knows?
Okay.
I mean, there were new indictments against President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and his deputy. And so indictments, plea bargains, all sorts of things continue to happen. And the real problem, I think, for President Trump is it's a distraction and it'll hang over his presidency until a report is finally issued. And who knows when that will be.
Linda, you know, if President Trump keeps saying no collusion, no collusion, there's nothing to see here. Why, if that's the case, why does he keep trying to undermine this investigation? If there's nothing there, why does he seem so desperate for Mueller to go away? Why be so worried about it?
Well, he thinks they're out to get him. If he believed that it was a truly straightforward, legitimate investigation, then he should say, there's nothing to see here, have at it, I'm clean. But he doesn't trust them. He should trust Robert Mueller. I can't think of anybody a straighter arrow than Robert Mueller. And I think what we've seen to date is an investigation that is happening in complete confidentiality. I mean, what's fascinating to me, in a city that leaks like a sieve, that none of these recent developments leaked in advance. So anybody who's making predictions about anything with this investigation, don't pay any attention, because we don't know what Mueller's got or what he's going to come out with.
There's another aspect of this that goes to the psyche and the President Trump. I mean, he seems obsessed with the notion that somehow his election last November was ill-gotten, that it was it has been tainted. Or I've heard Trump and his aides use the phrase delegitimizing my presidency or his presidency. The notion that the Russians helped, even if there was no collusion, the notion that the Russians were up to their eyeballs in trying to get Hillary Clinton to lose is seen by President Trump as an effort to delegitimize his presidency. And it would, with all respect, it drives him nuts. And I think that's the emotional component here. And one of the things I learned in covering Watergate as a very young reporter was a cardinal rule of damage control is, if you don't have anything to hide, don't behave like you do. And as Linda has said far more eloquently than I, time and again, it looks like the president has got something to hide. Now, that may be grossly unfair, but it's optics.
If you don't have anything to hide, don't behave like you do. That's very important phrase. All right, we're going to take a short break here. More issues in the news in just a moment.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House Correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. The Winter Olympics are winding down in South Korea. 2 weeks of competition. And by competition, I don't necessarily mean on the ski slopes or the ice rink. North Korea has participated in these games. At the opening ceremony, the sister of its leader, Kim Jong-un, showed up for a couple of days. And now we've learned that there was nearly a meeting between her and Vice President Mike Pence that apparently fell apart at the last minute. Linda, what happened?
That I don't know. I mean, the Pence agreed, and then members of the North Korean delegation backed out at the last minute. Maybe they thought that this would be bad for them. I honestly don't know. Maybe Tom can offer something.
Vice President Pence's office has said that the North Koreans thought that they could sway Pence and they could make it a propaganda, positive propaganda moment. But then, and again, this is the Pence version of what was in the North Koreans' mind. But after Pence started giving interviews and was making it clear that the United States was not going to blink on sanctions, or they're going to be even more stringent sanctions against the North Korean regime, that the North Koreans were just enraged and backed out 2 hours before the meeting. And so politically, it probably helps the administration either way. That one, they were willing to go down the diplomatic path, but two, the North Koreans look, how shall we say, small, petty, not committed to diplomacy. But I think that's what the White House and the Vice President's office is saying, and by way of explanation.
Well, they say they're not necessarily committed to diplomacy, but they have invited the South Korean President Moon to come to Pyongyang for a meeting. Perhaps they're kind of pursuing this on a different track.
Well, I'm talking about bilateral diplomacy between the United States and the North Koreans.
Right. All right. Linda, what at this closing ceremony, Ivanka mm-hmm. Trump, we know, is going to be there. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing about who, if anyone, she might possibly interact with?
Well, the North Koreans sent a general as soon as it was announced that Ivanka was coming. But frankly, I can't imagine that this will amount to anything. I'm not hearing any rumblings that there's going to be some kind of meeting between a North Korean general and Ivanka Trump. I think this is Ivanka Trump is being more sort of the glamorous emissary for Donald Trump. In fact, after Kim Jong-un's sister went to the Olympics, she was being called the Ivanka Trump of North Korea. So we are responding with the actual Ivanka Trump. She's had a meeting at the Blue House with the South Korean president. We've just gotten a report from American reporters on the scene, what they had for dinner. So I think this is kind of a soft ending to a 2-week episode that could have produced something, but I think clearly will not.
President Trump has said that he would be willing to meet with North Korea's Kim with a caveat if mm-hmm. the conditions were right. Are we any closer to that at this juncture, in your view?
I don't think so, but I think that posture is a reflection of the fact that the North and South Korean slight melting of tensions has made the United States odd man out, and that the U.S. therefore has decided it has to kind of get back into this game and look reasonable, look willing to talk.
Oh, Tom?
I agree with that. The Trump administration is very low. They don't like the notion of the North Koreans and the South Koreans talking much, and they especially do not like the notion of the South Korean president traveling north of the demilitarized zone to have meetings with Kim Jong-un. They've been trying to dissuade the South Koreans. They're probably not going to be successful in that endeavor, but you're right. The United States wants to be front and center here. And they're very wary of South Korea's president and his, to them, alleged a little too pacifistic attitude towards the North.
It's important to remember when you're talking about North Korea and all of that, that technically we are still at mm-hmm. war on the Korean Peninsula. The 1953, there was a truce signed, never a peace mm-hmm. pact. So is that kind of a complication, you think, that officially we're still at war with these people?
Right. It's an armistice. On the other hand, the sister of Kim Jong-un crossed the DMZ in the other direction to attend the Olympics. So it's technically, it is, you're absolutely correct, Paul. The two Koreas are still at war, technically. But I don't think that would be a huge impediment.
All right. Finally, here in the United States, Billy Graham has died at the age of 99. For listeners around the world who might be unfamiliar with who he was for decades a leading Christian leader in this country, a spiritual advisor, counselor, I think, to a dozen American presidents, going all the way back to Harry Truman, and he leaves quite a legacy. And Tom, you have some interesting thoughts on Billy Graham.
Well, Graham was referred to often in print as America's pastor, and it's true that he did counsel a lot of presidents, beginning with Truman, as you say, who didn't like him much, but Dwight Eisenhower, who liked him a lot, and he became indispensable. I know even Richard Nixon, in the darkest days of Watergate for Nixon, he asked to see Reverend Billy Graham. I also think that he had more, also had an international following, because I think he was the first pastor, evangelist to embrace the larger stage in the sense of international crusades in Western Europe, all around the country. And he would have these huge crowds. And this was before the age of televangelism like we see it today in this country, where you have these mega churches with tens of thousands of people showing up, and it all goes on television. As a matter of fact, there was once, allegedly, was some counseling by Queen Elizabeth to Queen Elizabeth II by Billy Graham at the moment when she was trying to decide what to do with her uncle, the former King Edward VIII, who became the Duke of Windsor because he renounced the throne. And anyone who's seen the miniseries The Crown, there's almost an entire episode talking about the Queen's faith and her intrigue with, not intrigue, her fascination with the message of Billy Graham. So he was quite an accomplished international, global pastor, I would say.
And Linda, to kind of bring this up to kind of the modern, sort of current era, sort of the force of evangelical Christians has really become quite influential in American politics. Ronald Reagan, for example, had their support. And there's also a fair number of reasons to believe that Donald Trump might not have won the presidency without their support either.
Absolutely. I mean, Billy Graham was a unifying force in politics. He was actually a registered Democrat, but that didn't matter. He appealed to both Republicans and Democrats. He was annually the most admired man in the world in the Gallup poll. But his part of his legacy, so Billy Graham has a very positive legacy, and his passing, I think, is emblematic of the passing of any kind of bipartisan comity in the United States. He gave us, among his five children, he gave us his son Franklin Graham, who has inherited the empire. And Franklin Graham endorsed Donald Trump and was important in establishing and promoting evangelical support for Mr. Trump, who, of course, has had a very messy personal life. But they put that aside. It's all in the name of policy. So Franklin Graham and others in the evangelical community have established that policies are more important than character, frankly, in the president.
I've been surprised at how they could sort of split their morality like that and kind of not pay attention to things. Had, say, a Democratic president done something like that, they would have had a far different view, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. But you look at the Supreme Court. We've got Neil Gorsuch as a new justice. He's very conservative, would presumably vote against abortion rights if it were to come up. I'm assuming on gun rights as well, even though that's not really an evangelical issue, but it's all sort of a piece of the conservative movement. And, you know, they are willing to look the other way when policies that are dear to their heart are on the line.
As a country overall, though, Tom, sort of the United States is becoming more secular. The issue of the power of Christian evangelists, is it what it used to be, and what might the political implications be going forward?
It's probably not as much what it used to be, but the point is the political strength of the evangelicals is paramount and is growing constantly with Donald Trump's base. They are a linchpin of the base that he strives to protect, that 30 to 35% of the country that show every indication of sticking with him no matter what. A huge component of that base is the evangelicals. And so it may be in decline overall, but I think it is still extremely critical to Republicans in a political sense, and especially President Trump at this particular moment.
So certainly potent enough as he heads into his presumed reelection campaign.
Exactly right.
All right. We're going to have to end it right there. Our thanks this week to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Linda Feldman. She's with the Christian Science Monitor. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you for listening.